Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. And, you know, on American Variety over the last, 4.5 years or so, we've had, about 150 guests so far. And all of them are talented, creative, you know, different kinds of people. As you know, they range across a huge spectrum, right? It's American Variety, okay? But, you know, passionate people, driven people, all, you know, highly intelligent. I mean, all above average. They're all from Lake Wobegon, I guess. And, but in my estimation, I don't think we've had anybody on the show who's been somebody who I suspected might be a genius. My guest today is somebody I suspect might be. I'm not looking at him as I say that because it's kind of ridiculous to say that in somebody's presence. But, you know, he looks like a normal professional man, maybe a doctor or a businessman or an executive. And, in fact, has been at least a couple of those, has founded a business and run it successfully and sold it. And his name is Terrence Witt. He's a an engineer by training and a physicist by, in practice and also by avocation, let's call it, lately. He's written a book called Our Undiscovered Universe, but really more to the point, has developed a wide-ranging and profound theory of the origin of the universe and the way the universe is structured and functions that runs kind of counter to a lot of the received wisdom in theoretical physics and cosmology today. So, Terrence, can I call you Terry?
Sure.
Welcome to the show. Thanks for being on. And so I guess let's just, maybe for the benefit of my listeners who, I have a background in chemistry, but I haven't practiced chemistry in, longer than the lives of many of the people listening. And I didn't study much about physics, so I'm only very superficial in my knowledge of physics, and so maybe I'm a better person than you to explain in 25 words or less the kind of the orientation toward physics. Most people are aware of Isaac Newton, who really kind of developed in the 1700s the idea of what's called Newtonian mechanics or classical mechanics, which is the sort of foundation of modern physics. Then it deals with the way objects interact in space, I think. It's probably a fair description. So in the maybe late 1800s and early 1900s, people like, Heisenberg and Planck and Niels Bohr and Einstein developed an elaboration of classical physics that's called quantum mechanics. You may have heard of that. And that deals more with the way particles and waves interact at the microscopic and much smaller than microscopic level as opposed to large objects that you can see and touch and feel. And so since that time, it's gotten into trying to figure out what some of the particles are that make up atoms and the component parts of atoms even. And so that's where you hear terms like quarks and bosons and muons and fermions and kind of a bewildering array of little particles that they try to create and track down and identify using these big super colliders, that those big ring-shaped structures where they run beams of electrons around and smash them into other beams of electrons, I guess. So, you know, all of us have a very kind of very distant, loose awareness of those kinds of things. And so Terry Witt has developed a concept that sort of goes beyond and explains a lot of the holes in theoretical physics, and I am certainly going to turn it over to you, Terry, to explain what null physics is. That's N-U-L-L, null physics.
Well, back in the day, we had natural philosophers. There was Lucretius, and these gentlemen would try to cipher out the nature of the universe, and they do it by sheer power of reason and logic. And around the 1700s, 1800s, that led kind of to globally to a dead end, because just scratching your head and wondering how things are. I mean, I think it was Democritus who figured out there were atoms probably 1,300 years before we ever saw one or ever had absolute proof that there were atoms. So they did make some progress, but the progress eventually kind of ground to a halt. And then we switched to this empirical heuristic approach to our physics, and natural philosophy became physics, where we measure and we correlate the measurements and we use math to be able to do calculations, to extrapolate. And that's incredibly useful when you want to build rockets and engines and transistors. But The problem is, if you try to apply that sort of approach to answering the really, really big questions like, why is the universe here, or what is everything ultimately made of, it ultimately fails. It will do everything that we can measure, and it'll extend to what we can measure, but you can't really explain what you can measure by measuring it. That's not the thing. You need logic. And so what happened was, we kind of threw logic in the dustbin and went with purely empiricism, which has great things, again, for engineering aspects, but you need logic to really get to a greater explanation of things. So basically, physics went from explaining things, or trying to explain things, to merely describing things. And what null physics does is it wants to do both. It wants to have a geometry that will give you things you can measure that will correlate precisely with what you can measure, but also have something that will explain what we're seeing while we're describing it.
All right. So, when I think of science, it is more a matter of explaining what is and explicating how it works. In other words, kind of looking at nature and taking it apart and breaking it into its component pieces and explaining how they all work together. And I understand that physics does that too with respect to the natural world, but you were saying that null physics also explains why, the purpose of that, and how do you approach that scientifically?
Well, there's a lot of things. For instance, if you look at the sun going across the sky, and you can, I think the Mayans even were able to describe what the sun was going to do any time of the year. They didn't know what the sun was, but they were able to describe it. And so typically in science, you can say, well, water, for instance, when it freezes, it gets less dense and it floats as ice. And so you can then stretch that and say, and you know why it does, because the molecules are farther apart. And so it's kind of like the little kid that just keeps asking, well, why? And eventually you have to draw a line where, okay, well, this question is philosophy and this is science. So there's always this line in the sand that is supposed to differentiate between the two. And what null physics does is it pushes it back and to the very, very beginning and treats the why does the universe exist as a physics problem and not a philosophy problem.
Okay, when you said why, I thought you meant that null physics explains the underlying purpose and meaning of the universe as opposed to why this phenomenon leads to this phenomenon. I can understand that part, but does null physics give us the big picture of what your view of the cosmos, and that's what cosmology is. It's the study of how the cosmos works, right, in a very large way, physics being the mechanisms that underlie that, I guess, right? And so we think of the Big Bang as being the sort of the beginning of the universe, and that's a pretty much accepted theory for the last 60 years or so, most of the last century. Does null physics have a totally different view of the beginning of the universe and how it's what kind of caused it?
Oh, absolutely. Null physics is diametrically opposed to the Big Bang. In fact, from my perspective, the Big Bang is kind of the 21st century version of the flat Earth. It's a very accurate description. It's a very detailed description of an alleged event. But the problem is it's, again, logically inconsistent. And you say that, well, everything after the first femtosecond after the universe emerged is science. Everything before that is philosophy. And the problem is the Big Bang has issues with, say, antimatter and matter. According to, the Big Bang, there should be half antimatter, half antimatter. Mm-hmm. Or half matter, half antimatter. And that's been kind of a glaring problem for 70 years. And also the Big Bang treats the universe like kind of a wind-up toy. And it shows a lack of respect for the intricacy and the majesty of the universe. It's not a wind-up toy that suddenly emerged a while ago and will wind down and die. It's much more breathtaking than that, actually. And so what null physics does is it looks at all the measurements that led to the Big Bang. Now, don't get me wrong, the measurements that led to the Big Bang are very compelling in their own right. There are mysteries when you're looking in deep space with microwaves. There's mysteries with the redshift. And there's mysteries, another great mystery is everywhere you look with a telescope, you can't see anything that's much older than 15 billion years. And so everywhere you look and you see these microwaves, for instance, well, you see objects, galaxies, for instance, they put out a few parts per million microwave radiation. Any hot object will put a little bit of microwave radiation out there. But when you measure the microwaves in space, they're 10 times the energy density of any other radiation in space. So the natural inclination is to say, well, something happened to generate all these microwaves. And then you look around seeing that nothing's that old, and you go, well, obviously the universe itself is not terribly old. And then the redshift, which Hubble discovered, say, well, clearly everything's just flying away from us because a Doppler effect will cause that redshift. So the observations, I'm not saying that the observations that led up to the Big Bang are wrong. Those are absolutely correct. What I'm saying is there's actually a simpler explanation for all the observations that we see. And it works in a universe that is infinitely old, not 13.7 billion years old.
You're listening to American Variety Radio, and I'm your throat-clearing host, Court Lewis, talking with Terrence Witt about his theory, Null Physics, which is kind of a new, in a way, revolutionary view of the universe and the way it's structured. So, Terrence, you're saying that that rather than a particular moment in time where a tiny, infinitesimally small particle of matter exploded in some cataclysmic way that's hard to imagine and led to the entire expanding universe that we can see with telescopes today, instead of that, there was no beginning point? It began infinitely? It never began?
No, there was never any beginning. And even Lucretius knew this 2,000 years ago. He just didn't know why. Because a beginning in time is the same as a beginning in anything else, a first chicken before there ever was an egg. It's logically inconsistent. And your mind kind of revolts at, well, if there is a beginning, well, what happened before that? What caused it? There's this host of problems that have no resolution. And so you draw this firm line in the sand saying, well, that's philosophy. This is science. But in reality, there is a logical explanation for the presence of the universe. Because all these theories, any sort of cosmology is trying to answer the question of why is there something here instead of nothing? That is the original, that's the question that gets carved on cave walls. That's the question that Einstein battled, Lucretius battled, they battled since time one. And my premise is that is actually a physics problem. It's not a philosophy problem because the reason why the universe is here, if you understand why the universe is present instead of nothing, then that might tell you other things about its properties, like its universal constants, like the other things we observe, its continuous space. All these things are related to why it's here. Just like if you say, well, why is that chicken there? Where did that chicken come from? Well, it came from an egg. It's on this planet called Earth. It's got certain sort of parameters, one gravity of attraction, one atmospheric pressure, and all these things are related to the way the chicken is. Obviously, the chicken can't be 40 stories tall or do other things. All these things are related. You can't just draw a line in the sand and hope to explain why the universe is the way it is if you don't know where it came from or why it's here. And so that's when physics, well, null physics, we call that physics problem number one, and we face it directly. We explain why the universe is here instead of nothing.
I mean, we're used to the concept of everything having a beginning, you know, and whether it's a chicken or an egg, at least they both had a beginning, and you go back enough in time, eventually you find some primordial egg thing, you know, that there was a beginning to it. It's hard to conceive of a universe that has existed beyond infinity, and you know, I guess it gets into your concept of what is time then or something, because it's you know, a universe that has always been here is just hard to conceive of. And I guess I'll just leave that alone because it's beyond my ability to imagine a lack of beginningness to the universe. But you did mention the redshift, which is kind of, you know, for those who may not realize what that is in astronomy, it's the same thing as when a train approaches you and the sound of the whistle or the horn changes as it approaches you and recedes from you. That's a Doppler shift because the wavelength of those waves, those sound waves, is stretched or compressed as it's coming, going away from you or coming toward you, and it changes the way your ear perceives the sound. And so the light coming off of distant galaxies or stars that are observed by telescope changes and shifts more toward the red as they get faster and faster going away from you. And so Edwin Hubble back in the early, 1916 or something, discovered that the farthest ones away were the reddest and seemed to be going away the fastest. And so that led to the idea of an expanding universe. So with all that preamble, is the universe expanding according to null physics?
Absolutely not. In fact, Edwin Hubble, what he measured was a redshift. And to his dying day, he did not think that the universe was expanding, because the other things he saw when he looked at the heavens were a very random-looking distribution of galaxies, and there was no evidence whatsoever other than the redshift that it was expanding. And so various other theories. There was a gentleman called Fritz Zwicky in the 1930s or late 20s, that said that something was happening to the light, and he coined something called the tired light hypothesis.
Tired light?
Tired light, yeah.
It ran out of brightness and turned red?
Yeah, because red light has less energy, so it just was exhausted by the time, and I think it was a derisive term, actually, but because they're trying to figure out, they've got this redshift, and nothing else seems to indicate an expanding universe, so what's going on? And as it turns out, tired light doesn't answer any of the questions with the redshift, because like the microwaves and like this apparent age of the universe, it's a deep mystery. And the people that think that light is just losing energy by running into gas or neutrinos or gravitons, they don't appreciate the depth of these observations. And the interesting thing about the redshift is you've got a proportional loss of energy. So radio waves, if they lose 20% of energy, then optical radiation and all radiation loses from the same object, it loses the same percentage. So you don't see that in collision losses. The other thing you don't see is if there were any sort of interaction with matter, you get this nice chromatic aberration you see once in a while if you're looking at the edge of your glasses or any sort of glass with light going through it, you'll see a rainbow effect. Well, that's caused by the fact that light of different frequencies goes different speeds when it interacts with some sort of medium. So if this light was interacting with matter in deep space, the red light would get here at a different time than the blue light, and that doesn't happen either. So and what's particularly enigmatic about the redshift is supernova, type 1A supernova. That's a type of supernova where you've got a little white dwarf as a companion star, and it's kind of siphoning off material from another star, and it reaches this point where it gets so massive and it's collected so much of this material that it just explodes. And the cool thing about type 1A supernova is that this explosion usually happens right at, about the same mass every time. So it becomes a nice standard. Because it'll create this light curve that has a certain brightness, it has a certain duration, and you can see it in galaxies far, far away. And but anyway, you can see it in galaxies to the point where a type 1A supernova is actually, it has a brightness comparable to a galaxy. So when you look at these signals from these supernovae, you notice that the broadening where these supernovae, it's, like this very, very brief, cosmologically speaking, event, you'll notice that the broadening of the event, the duration of the event seems to stretch out. So whereas before, if the supernovae were nearby, it'd be like a 100-day event. If it's billions of light years away, it'll be a 200-day event. So not only is this redshift stretching the light and making the light longer, it's actually stretching the distance between the photons that we receive. And you certainly don't get that from tired light. And so what happens with the people that have a problem with this is they just don't dig into it deep enough to know a viable explanation or a viable counter-explanation.
Terry, this is obviously a deep and complex and broad subject. Your book, as I mentioned at the outset, is called Our Undiscovered Universe, Introducing Null Physics, the Science of Uniform and Unconditional Reality. So again, Our Undiscovered Universe, And anybody who's interested can go to the website www.ourundiscovereduniverse.com and read a lot about the book and the theory and Terry and comments on his theory. And this, by the way, is a beautiful book. It's it has all the production values, as they say. The thing is truly a weighty tome. I think it weighs about 5 pounds and is about 500 pages long. And it's extremely well done. A very nice hardcover book. Great printing values and paper and production and design and all that. And it's it's a heavy read, but you can go, you can kind of, the Cliff Notes version is you can read the beginning and the end of each chapter, and there's sort of an introduction to the problem and the situation, and then the, and then there's a conclusion that kind of wraps it up in terms that a lay person can understand at the end of each chapter, and then at the end of the book there's a concluding chapter that kind of describes the whole thing again, but it, you know, it's called Null Physics, and we can't get into it, you know, like the description Terry just gave of one little aspect, you know, is a page in the book of a 500-page book, right? But it really, it's a grand unifying theory that answers a lot of unanswered questions that I guess even theoretical physicists have long realized are unanswered questions in the prevailing theories of the universe and cosmology. But Terry, you're an engineer, an electrical engineer by education, and became an inventor in the biomedical field and an entrepreneur, started a company, as I said at the outset, and you know, we're very successful in that, but that's a far cry from reinventing the universe. How did you, you know, what's the Cliff Notes version, I guess, of how you got into this arena?
Well, you can tell a scientist when they're 8 years old, they're the kid that's collecting bugs and putting them in a box. And I was born a scientist. And when I went to school originally at Oregon State University, I went into physics. But early on, I had some problems with paradigms and some problems where they had drawn the lines where physics was supposed to end and philosophy began. And I got into long discussions with some of my professors about quantum physics and, you know, just turning back the clock a little bit and reevaluating some of these things. And, you know, they were going to have none of that. And so it became very clear that if I wanted a career, it wasn't going to be in theoretical physics. So I kind of switched over to engineering because the other thing I liked doing was building things. And so once my company became successful and I kind of moved on, then I picked this up again. And I'd always been working on it, even part-time. And I'd hired some graduate students in astrophysics to dig out some data. And every piece of data I found kept agreeing more and more with me. So finally, I just put it all into a book and just to get it out there. My biggest fear was that I had 30 years worth of work and that I'd get run over by a truck and no one would ever hear about it.
Well, science is like religion in many ways. And one of them is that there are competing sects, right? And disagreements over dogma that go on very heatedly for generations even, you know, and even as we see, there are wars over such things, right, and have been throughout human history. So I don't think in science they take pot shots so much at each other other than verbally or in the journals. But there definitely is a sociology to science, and a core part of it is that unless you're a member of the club, unless you have the right PhD in the right specialty areas from, and really what it comes down to, the right universities in many cases, you're not listened to if you have any divergent point of view, and we're talking even mildly divergent points of view on small points, but you have a tremendously divergent point of view on the entire kind of premises of theoretical physics, and you're not a PhD physicist with a doctoral degree from Princeton or Harvard or Yale or Stanford, and you're an electrical engineer, and I would imagine that is a major barrier. So have you... It goes without saying that your premise is not going to be readily accepted by the theoretical physicist community because it undermines all of the work they do and the things that the premises they go on. And so having said that, what kind of strategy do you have for pushing this very fundamental revolutionary concept in a way that might increase its acceptability to mainstream science?
Well, my initial strategy is that five-pound book.
Yeah.
Just the sheer preponderance and the weight of the evidence that I present, I thought would be overwhelming and difficult to argue with. And it is if you actually read it.
And I have to interject that the book is written in an extremely lucid, clear, logical way. I mean, it just flows like, you know, water flowing down a stream. It's easy to understand if you skip the quadratic equations and so on. but the prose of it is written in a very straightforward way, and it's easy to understand as much as such a thing can possibly be. But go ahead.
Well, and that's the thing. The other point of the book is to demystify a lot of the theoretical physics. stuff. That it's funny. Generally, I've seen theoretical physicists look down on applied physicists, who in turn look down on engineers.
Yeah.
And I think we're running in the front of a train somewhere. But the difference actually in engineering is that when you're wrong, something actually breaks. And being wrong has serious consequences, whereas if, for instance, the Big Bang was wrong for the last 70 years, the consequences are less serious. So from my standpoint, I certainly have made no friends in theoretical physics community there. Somehow I managed to transform from a leader in the biomedical industry to a crackpot in theoretical physics almost overnight. And one thing you'll notice in all this is the other thing I find particularly fascinating in terms of just sociology, the vitriol with which they attack a book and with which they refuse to read the book, I find that incredibly interesting. And I've had discussions with gentlemen, and I use that term loosely, and where I get them right to the point where we're talking about logic and reason, and as soon as we bump up to the point where a new concept needs to be introduced, then the vitriol starts flying. And so they're very resistant to change. The plate tectonics, for instance, took 50 years to be adapted. And I guarantee you that my book's a little more abstract than plate tectonics. But the nice thing is I am trying to demystify the theoretical physics. There is a logical, rational explanation for our universe's properties. And that's what I presented to the best of my ability to write it anyway.
Well, we mentioned that you started and ran a very successful biomedical company. It wasn't a huge company, but I gather it from looking it up, actually, that it was one of the, if not the best biomedical company in its field in the world, and was bought by a very large multinational corporation. So you did well there a couple of years ago. And I suspect that unlike most purported crackpots, you have one thing most of them don't have, which is the financial resources to push this idea creatively if you wanted to. And I wonder whether we just have a minute or so left, but there must be a strategy by which you can work your way into conferences and if buy a copy for every physics department in the United States or something like that, catch the imagination of some graduate students who aren't yet infected with a fear of their funding from NSF or the DOE or whatever disappearing if they adopt an idea that's outside the mainstream. So do you have such a strategy in 20 seconds or less?
Well, the strategy so far is rapidly evolving, okay. I should say. We try one thing, see how that works. We try another. Just getting books out there, getting in the bookstores, and just kind of a grassroots effort right now, because the doors to the castle are high and they're bolted very securely. But reason will out, and eventually I'm hoping that the other part of the strategy is the big telescopes that are going online. I've predicted what they will see. Mm. I've got some very, very quantifiable predictions in the book, even much in the way that Einstein predicted things in 1915. And so I'm just waiting for someone to test them.
Okay.
I welcome them.
So that can be the hook. If somebody finds something that you've predicted that is not predicted by a current theory, then you're in business. But Terry Witt, thank you very much for being on with us, and thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in next Sunday, same time, same place, for more American Variety. And before I forget, our undiscoveredUniverse.com. Go there, buy the book. Thanks again.